This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Sydney Biddle Barrows, who became known as the Mayflower Madam when her escort service was busted in 1984. Barrows ran one of the priciest and most selective call girl services in New York. Men paid between $175 and $200 an hour for the companionship and sexual services of women under 25. Barrows ran the service under a pseudonym. Her clients and employees had no idea that she was listed on the social register and was descended from two prestigious families. Her father is a Biddle, one of Philadelphia's premier families, and one of her mother's ancestors sailed to America on the Mayflower. Barrows told her family that she ran a fashion accessory business. They were scandalized to learn through the newspaper headlines what business she was really in. Barrows wrote a book about her secret life called The Mayflower Madam. She collaborated on it with William Novak, who co-authored Lee Iacocca's best-selling autobiography. We talked about her experiences running the escort service. I asked her what kind of men her service catered to.
Actually, believe it or not, the reason I think it was so successful is because the type of men that I tried to appeal to were the type of men that I dated, the type of men that I knew in my personal life. I think one of the reasons I was so successful in appealing to these men and giving them the type of service and the type of women that they were looking for is because I knew what they wanted from firsthand experience. And I think the majority of people who run that type of business are men, and they, most of them are real lowlifes, not all of them, but, most of them are. They have no idea what men of that caliber are looking for, and I did.
Which was what?
They were looking for attractive, bright, warm, articulate girls to come and keep them company. I think it's a misconception that these men only call the girls up for sex. The fact that they kept them for 2, 3, 4, 5, 8 hours at a time and maybe only went to bed with them, if at all, for about 10 minutes of that time, 5 or 10 minutes. They really wanted companionship. A lot of people look at me and they say, come on, Sydney, no one's going to pay $175 an hour to sit around and talk to someone. Believe me, they really did. People don't want to believe it, but they really did.
So what were the techniques you used to recruit the kind of women that you thought would have the looks and the intelligence, blah, blah, that you thought the clients wanted?
I ran ads in the Village Voice in the Help Wanted section and in Show Business Magazine to attract some of the aspiring models, actresses, and dancers. And at 12 o'clock, I had a group interview every Thursday at 12 o'clock. Girls who had never worked came in. And at 1 o'clock, girls who either had worked before or who knew the score came in. And that was the preliminary interview. And from the preliminary interview, I picked the few girls, and sometimes I went 2 or 3 weeks with finding nobody. I picked the girls that I felt would be right for the agency. With the girls who'd never worked and who had no idea what was going on, what I would do is I would call them up and I would say, I've got some good news and I've got some bad news. The bad news is I haven't got an opening for anyone in your category right now. However, I do have a small number of clients who occasionally like to see the girls on a more personal basis. The pay is very good. It's very safe. We really check these guys out very well. If this is something that might interest you, you could come in and talk to me about it. If it's not something that interests you, I would never compromise you. I will leave your name in the Strictly Social file, and I'll contact you as soon as something comes up. And that's all I said. I never pushed them any further. And those who were interested said, couldn't hurt to come in and talk to her. And some said, I knew that was all about. I'll be in tomorrow. And then the others said, I just don't think that's right for me. I'd rather wait until something Strictly Social came along. Well, in point of fact, there wasn't anything Strictly Social. But, we could hardly come right out and say that.
What prepared you in your background for this experience? You'd never given sex for money, I assume. And
I
you'd
didn't
never
even know what a call girl really was. I'd never thought about them. I used to get a kick driving up 8th Avenue in a taxi, seeing the girls on the street. Like everybody else in the world, when I heard the word, prostitute or call girl, I would pretty much think of girls on the street. Well, if I thought of a call girl, I would think of some incredibly beautiful, well-dressed, well-groomed, elegant, sophisticated girl who, got hundreds of dollars an hour for her time. But I never really knew any of these people or even knew of them. It was just sort of a fantasy I had in my own mind as to what they were.
When you hired a woman to work for you, how did you train her? Was there an initiation period, something like that? What did you tell her about the image she was supposed to have when she went out to work for you?
Image was extremely important. One of the things I told them to always keep in the front of their mind, that when men called us, what I would say to them is, I said, before you knew me, what was your image of a high-class, real expensive New York call girl? And I made them, and they would all say, just like I just said, real sophisticated, attractive, well-groomed, et cetera, et cetera. And I looked at them and I said, that is what these men are expecting to walk through their door. Well, all of a sudden, the girls' eyes would bulge and they'd say, oh my God, but I'm just plain old Susie. I'm not this fantasy call girl. And I would say, well, what we're going to do is we are going to work together and we are going to create a physical image for you. And what we would do is, for instance, we had somebody who looked like a girl next door, someone who looked like a girl fresh off the farm. We had our New York sophisticate look. We had our student look, our model look, because lots of, you know, all men have lots of different tastes. And so what we were essentially doing is marketing these girls. They each had their own little market slot. And they had hairdos to match and makeup to match and clothes to match. This might not have been who they were in their personal lives, but as I said to them, think of it as a uniform. When you're working for me, this is the way we are selling you, the way we're presenting you.
You had many of the women dress as if they were executives so that they wouldn't look like a mistress when they were dining out with a man?
Well, we first of all didn't want, let's say that he were to run into somebody who he knew in his personal life. We would want to be able to pass the girl off as either a business associate or possibly his daughter's college roommate. So she had to look very clean cut. Also, don't forget, a lot of these girls were walking through hotel lobbies rather late at night. And it was very important that they have a business-like appearance so that they would not be stopped by security. For instance, they always had to wear a dress or a suit. The pants of any type were not permitted ever. Neither were boots. The only concession we ever made to sexiness was very high heels. Don't ask me why, but men seem to love very high heels. I mean, every time I wear them and I think of that, I go, oh, God, why can't they like me in flats? Because they're so much more comfortable. We also had them always wear matching bra, panty, and garter belts underneath. And a great many men like that.
You train the women who work for you in things like how to enter a hotel without attracting attention and without making people think that you really are what you are, which is a high-priced prostitute. So what are the directions you'd give for how to do that?
Well, for instance, if somebody had very long, beautiful blonde hair and was very striking looking, it would be very foolish of her to go parading through the lobby looking like that because everyone's going to look at her. So we would have her put her hair up, say, in a beret. Especially late at night, anybody wearing very high heels might be a little suspect. So a lot of the girls carry those little canvas Chinese sandals in their bags. One of the things that I always had the girls carry was briefcases. Now, when we first started out in 1979, very, very, very few women were traveling on business. And just about the only girl that you would ever see in a hotel lobby after, say, 9 or 10 o'clock was generally a working girl. Well, what happened is as women did start to travel more for legitimate business with IBM, with AT&T, et cetera, they started being hassled by the hotel security guards. Well, you know, these women took a very dim view of being accused of being ladies of the evening, and a lot of lawsuits developed. So the hotel security people became very leery of stopping anybody who thought might even possibly be a very legitimate businesswoman. So what I did is I always had the girls carry briefcases, and because they always did look so ladylike and so very straight and conservative, we never had a problem with girls in the hotels. They wouldn't risk it.
We've all heard stories about judges and chief executive officers and diplomats who by day are very straight and businesslike and really know their work inside out and so on and so on. But at night, they want to dress up in diapers and be spanked or whatever, that they have these, you know, very unusual sexual tastes. Did you find that to be common, that, that, you know, successful men, when they used your service, had very peculiar requests of the women?
I think what most people don't realize is there are places that specialize in that sort of thing. It's called dominance, and it's sort of a specific type of business in that field. And the men that wanted that sort of thing did not call an agency like mine. If this was somebody who wanted to dress up in women's clothes or, as you say, wear diapers or wanted someone to tie him up or whatever, he would never call my agency. Well, they did call and they would say, do you do dominance or do you do fantasies? And we would always say no, and I would refer them to another woman I know who did do such things. But they wouldn't waste their time and their money calling an agency like mine and have a girl come over who hadn't had a clue as to what they wanted. You know, men who have, quote, sexual perversions, unquote, have very exact ideas of what those perversions are, and they only will call a place that can satisfy those needs.
So there's,
and we weren't them.
There's specialty operations
for
that.
They really are, believe it or not.
people are always curious when it comes to working women, whether they enjoy the sex that they're getting paid for and how it compares to sex that you actually have with someone who you feel intimate with, who you feel sexual towards. Did you want to talk to the women who you worked with about that? Were you curious about that too?
Not really. I felt that it would be in very bad taste when they came back from a call for me to sit down and say, oh, so how was it? You know, I just thought that that was just not a very nice thing to do. Every once in a while, the girls would come back, and the most that they would say is, you know, is he was easy? He wasn't so easy. He really got his money's worth. And every once in a while, you'd have a girl say, God, he was just a great lover. But you have to remember something, that when you are making love with someone that you have a relationship with and you have a lot of feelings with, you really are making love, and you do spend a lot of time doing it because you are both showing each other how much you care for each other. When you are sleeping with someone that you really don't know that well, you might like them, you might think they're nice, but you really don't have that many emotional feelings for them. It really becomes sort of what could be known as a quickie. You know, there is no love and caring and tenderness involved to that extent that it would take a long time. I think most of the men just sort of wanted to do it and go to sleep right afterwards. They really didn't want to spend a long time, you know, with a person that they just really didn't know that well. And, of course, that was much easier on the girls. There are a lot of wives out there, I'm sure, who are thrilled when their husbands only spend 5 minutes instead of you know, taking 20.
What was your policy toward menstruation? Could a woman work if she was menstruating?
No, I think that there are enough men who find that a turnoff. And I think most girls are very uncomfortable working at that time of the month. So we did request that they not work. And most of them were just as pleased not to.
Was there a kind of birth control you required they use? Could they use a diaphragm, for instance?
I was surprised how few of them used the pill. I would have thought that would have been the birth control method of choice, but believe it or not, the vast majority did use a diaphragm. I'm not exactly sure why, but they did. The only girl who, you know, it's funny, a lot of them would come in there and they'd know they were going to go out there and be call girls, and yet none of them had thought about birth control. And at the end of each interview, I would always go around the room and I would say, well, you know, what are you using? And it was very odd that at least 50% of them just weren't using anything, and they sort of gave me this dumb look like, oh, my God, that's right. I need to do something about this. So my own personal gynecologist got a lot of referrals.
I was actually surprised to read that until there was an outbreak of gonorrhea that started to afflict a lot of your clients and the women who worked for you, that you really didn't make condoms compulsory. You asked the women who worked for you to carry a few high-quality ones with them. So should the client want to use a condom, he'd have a choice of a very good one, and he'd have the availability of it. But why didn't you require it for prophylactic purposes?
Because the clients that we had just did not want to use them. They would not have called our agency had we required them to use them.
You started your service before awareness of AIDS.
And herpes, believe it or not. There was no herpes around. Well, it had not been publicized when we started the agency either.
Well, how did the escalation in sexually transmitted diseases and then the development of AIDS affect you and affect your views of what people need to do to protect themselves if they're having sex with different people?
Well, fortunately, AIDS was not a problem. I mean, not that it wasn't a problem, but it was barely being recognized when I was in business. It really is. I was busted in 1984, in the fall of 1984, and it really wasn't until the summer of 1985 that it really was highly publicized that there was a problem. And I think if I had stayed in business, if I was still in business, say right now, I would either have to insist that everyone use condoms or I would have had to go out of business.
My guest is Sydney Biddle Barrows, who became known as the Mayflower Madam. Her lineage goes back to the Mayflower, and she was the head of an escort service in New York before she was busted. Mayflower Madam is also the name of her new book. I always thought that women who started to run services of their own had kind of come up through the ranks and that they had been a call girl themselves before becoming the owner of a call girl operation. Since you've told us you didn't have any experience like that, how did you really get to know what you needed to convey to the women who worked for you so that they would know how to behave, so that they wouldn't get themselves into trouble and so on?
Well, now, don't forget, I never told them anything sexual. I felt if they didn't know how to do it, the last thing that was going to help them was hearing about anything from me. When I held this re-interview, it was really business policies that we went over. And as I said before, over the years, I just sort of more and more things came up, so there were more and more things to tell the girls. But, you know, the girls would come back from a call, and they would say, for instance, that's how we got into the lingerie. The girls would come back. The few girls that wore garter belts and panties would tell us what an incredible, how much the men loved it. I had a girl once who wore a hat with a veil once, got a huge response from it. And every time she went to a guy in a hat with a veil, he loved it. Well, then she would come back and tell the other girls. So the other girls would go out and do it. You know, and you know, the girls exchange tips between each other. You know what men like, what they don't like. They would really exchange sort of sex tips, if you want to call them that, or other kinds of tips between themselves, far more than they would ever share them with me. I was always so conscientious of them not feeling that I was sort of had this prurient interest and was you know, sort of listening in to, you know, what I'm trying to say. I was trying to be very careful about that.
But there's something else that you could have been feeling. I wonder if you ever felt that you were buying and selling women's bodies and that you were guilty of exploiting their sexuality, exploiting their most, you know, intimate part of their lives for financial gain.
Well, I think what you have to remember is these girls did this by choice. It was their moral values and their personal sensibilities that they had to sort and sift through and decide, do I want to take this job? Once they had decided to take this job, or a job like this, then it was a matter of for whom am I going to work? And I know that I presented the best alternative. I mean, I ran my business in a way that enabled them to maintain their dignity, to maintain their safety and their health. And as long as they were going to do it anyway, they were quite frankly better off doing it for me than for anybody else. I really don't feel I exploited them at all. And I actually saved them from having to go through a horrible experience like that. Now, I think people are saying, oh, she's thinking she saved them. Who does she think she is? I think that this is a personal privacy issue. There are a number of personal privacy issues that seem to be in the forefront these days. Most of them seems to be before the Supreme Court. And I think that if most people seem to have a knee-jerk reaction when they hear the word prostitution. You know, they get all kinds of negative feelings and negative thoughts about it. And I think if people really sit down and think about it, what people do in the privacy of their own bedroom, what two consenting adults do in the privacy of their own bedroom is quite frankly nobody's business but their own. And while a lot of people have said to me, but Sydney, they were prostituting themselves. Well, you know what I say to them? I say they didn't feel that way about it. And it really is how you feel about yourself and the decisions you make for yourself that are really important, not what other people think. A lot of people don't believe that living together before marriage is right. And yet there are a lot of people who feel that it's right for them.
Would you ever have done it?
I never had any desire to do it. I'm a very long-term relationship person. The first man I ever slept with, I went out with for 3 years. And the next man was 2 years, and then 4 years. So to me, sex was always a way of telling somebody how much you love them, how much you care about them. It was sort of like a way of speaking to each other. And I never felt I had anything to say to somebody that I didn't really know. I have never had a one-night stand.
If you don't mind my asking, did your sex life change by virtue of the operation you were in? Did you start getting more exotic interests or tastes or anything through
I have to admit, I did go out and buy a bra, panties, and garter belt. And it worked. He loved it. But other than that, not really, no. Not really. I think I was pretty free and open in that respect myself anyway. I'm a very non-judgmental, very open-minded person about most things. I don't necessarily agree with other people's choices, but I feel that it's their right to make that choice.
Would you explain the laws surrounding escort services? We know that prostitution isn't legal. Now, an escort service does not advertise itself as a prostitution service. Maybe you can even describe what your ad said, because you did indeed take out ads.
Okay, now there is a difference, I think, between prostitution and an escort service. A prostitute sells a specific sexual act. Okay, I will not name what they are on the radio. I think we can all imagine what they are. But when a client goes to a prostitute, you know, this is the specific sexual act he bargains for. This is the amount of money she charges him for. And then they kind of lay down and do it. With an escort service, the client pays for the young lady's time. He pays the exact same amount of money no matter what he does or does not do. If he doesn't get sex during that hour, he doesn't pay any less. If he does have sex during that hour, he doesn't pay any more. He pays for her time. And I think that is the major difference between sort of being an escort and being a prostitute. Now, that's not to say that I think that being an escort is better. These girls out there on the street, they know what they're doing. That while a lot of them might not like the work, let's face it, there are a lot of people who go do something legitimate every day that they don't like. But this is an economic opportunity for these women that they have chosen to do. There is no one forcing them to do it. There is no one making them do it. They can make more money doing this than anything else, and they choose to do it.
Can you tell us very briefly why you think you were busted and how you were busted?
Well, it's very simple. A greedy landlord who wanted his apartment back managed to convince a cop who wanted a promotion that I was the biggest, the best, the brightest, and the smartest. So he would be the biggest, the best, the brightest, and the smartest if he got me. I think he also alluded to the fact it was a multimillion-dollar business. Perhaps there was organized crime involved. Perhaps there was political corruption involved. And what this landlord did is he just got this cop salivating to the, you know, thinking that he was going to be made captain of the police force by getting me. And what he found out, much to his chagrin, and he is no longer with the police department, but what he found out, much to his chagrin, after he busted me was that this landlord had just been making this up and had been, you know, using all these things to incite him to get him to do his dirty work for him. And that's exactly what happened.
You spent, a few hours in jail before you were released?
I went in about 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, and I got out about 10 o'clock at night. And I have to tell you, it was one of the most fascinating, interesting experiences of my life. It really was. I would do it all over again. I wouldn't want to do it often. But it was really an opportunity to sit down and talk to a segment of society that somebody like me just never has the opportunity to meet or to talk to. And I just want to tell you how very warm and kind and friendly and nice these girls were. Yes, they were very bizarre looking. Yes, they did not speak English the way you and I do. Yes, their values and the things that they do with their life and their money were not what you or I would choose to do with our money. But when it came down to the kind of people they were, I cannot tell you how nice and friendly they were to me and to each other.
How did you get off after you were busted?
Well, this was such a huge embarrassment to the district attorney's office. First of all, it was not a multimillion-dollar-a-year business. There was no official corruption. There were no drugs. There were no underage girls involved. It became so obvious within the first few hours that this was a very, very nice, well-run business. And then the phone calls started coming. Most of our men were so highly placed that they either knew, you know, someone in the district attorney's office, or they had lawyer friends who knew. And everyone started calling in their chips because they thought, oh, my God, you know, my career, you know, because I was getting so much publicity that these men were terrified that, if the case went on any longer, that they might be exposed and their marriages and their professional lives would be severely compromised. The district attorney couldn't wait to get rid of this case, and they finally made me an offer I couldn't refuse. They offered me a $5,000 fine. And, I said, sure. I was ready to quit at that point.
Well, your cover was blown. Everybody knew that you were from the Biddle family, that your mother's lineage went back to the Mayflower, because you had been not even telling most of your friends and family.
Very few of my friends even knew that. I'm not a name dropper. I'm not somebody who talks about things like that. It's enough for me that I know that.
Well, did this feel like a real contradiction to you, to be someone descended from these two prestigious American families and be running an escort service at the same time? Did that cause you a lot of...
I don't think I ever thought about it. I don't think I ever thought about it.
What about your family? Did they feel I lived?
They thought about it. They were not amused. But I think the farther away they were on the relationship scale, the funnier and more amusing they thought it was. Obviously, the closer they were, such as my parents, my grandparents, the less amusing they found it. Because people would obviously say, you know, what kind of daughter, what kind of grandchild did you bring up that she would do this? But in spite of everything, my mother especially has just been terrific. She does not approve of it. She does not condone it. But her attitude is, you're still my daughter, and I love you. And although I don't like what you did, I certainly don't have any argument with the way you did it. And I find that that has been many people's reaction. They don't like what I did, but they certainly can't criticize the way I did it.
The escort service got you, the bust also got you and your mother thrown off of the social register.
Yes, it did.
Did that mean a lot to you or to her?
Well, I think What the social register means to most people is it's somebody saying you are good enough, you have the right lineage, that you qualify to be in here. I think it's really qualifying is the most important thing. So everybody knows we qualify. That's really, to me, as good as being in there.
Well, you run your escort service. You would talk to people over the phone sometimes, but you'd never meet the clients in person.
See, a real madam, I am not technically a real madam. A real madam meets all of her clients and personally introduces the client and the girls. So I was technically not a real madam.
Okay. But you never met the clients. You'd talk to them on the phone sometimes, though you'd hire women to actually talk to them on the phone, too. But I'm sure, since these men were such well-connected men at the pinnacle of their profession, blah, blah, that you probably knew some of them through through other social circles, and I bet you're running into some of them now. What's it like now that your cover's blown, and when you run into someone who you knew was one of your clients, and now they know that you ran the escort service that they secretly use?
I think that they're very embarrassed. I think that, especially if it's a surprise meeting and they don't know I'm going to be there, they sort of stand there with this stricken look on their face and, oh, my God, is she going to do anything that gives me away? And I always act as though I'd never met them before in my entire life. I mean, I never even give them a little knowing wink or even a little longer. I don't even hold their eye a little longer. I really act as though I had never seen them before. And then I think they sit there and think, well, maybe she doesn't remember me, you know. But, no, I would never do anything. You know, I felt that when they called, part of the deal was one of the things they were paying for was privacy and discretion. And even though the business is no longer in business, I do not feel that I would never in a million years dream of ever exposing any of them. I have far too much integrity for that.
That was Sydney Biddle Barrows. Her memoir is titled The Mayflower Madam. It's published by Arbor House. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. The engineers for this edition were Jay Goldman and Paul Keller. Fresh Air is edited by associate producer Amy Sallet. Assistance from Marty Moss Cohen. Danny Miller and I are the producers of the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
This edition of Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order a cassette of this interview, or for a listing of other programs available on cassette, call toll-free 800-253-0808. In Alaska and Wisconsin, call 608-263-4802. That number again for a cassette of Fresh Air is 800-253-0808. National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible in part with funds provided by Philadelphia-based Cigna Corporation, a provider of insurance and related financial services to businesses and individuals worldwide. Additional funding comes from NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.